You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams there at the top of any baseball fan's list of all-time great players. One man who doesn't appear as often on those lists today is Stan Musial. A fan favorite in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, he played for the St. Louis Cardinals for 22 seasons and became one of the game's best all-time hitters. Now, New York Times sports columnist George Vesey has reminded us why the Hall of Fame player, who was called Stan the Man, used to be considered something of a national treasure. In his book called Stan Musial, An American Life, it's published by ESPN Books, an imprint of Ballantine Books, and I'm pleased that it has brought George Vesey back to our show. Hello.
How are you? We're big fans. Nice to be here.
Isn't Stan Musial 90 years old now?
He is indeed. In fact, almost 91.
Were you able to talk to him about his
career? I was not. He's not in good shape enough to talk. And also, in the 15 years or so preceding, he had pretty much made it a policy that he and his inner circle did not give interviews for one reason or another. So I did not have access to him or his house. One of his children did speak to me, and she was generous and kind and loves her family and was very helpful.
Well, last February, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and I was wondering, what took so long?
That's the story of his life, particularly if you go to St. Louis this week or any week, is that they feel that he was overlooked in a lot of ways psychically over the years. So somebody added up all the athletes who had received the Presidential Medal, and they said, well, why not Stan? And it's part of the sort of campaign from St. Louis is to get him his just due, you know, before. They just feel he deserves it.
Is the feeling that if he had played in New York or some other East Coast team or even Chicago, that he would be remembered better because his statistics are extraordinary?
Oh, he was a great player. I mean, he was voted the best baseball player of the decade, of the post-war decade from 46 to 55, which includes Williams, DiMaggio, Jackie Robinson, Bob Feller. Now, granted that some of them had missed time during the war, but from 46 to 55, he was the great player in baseball. And his statistics back it up. People look and you say, well, look at this guy. He hit for quite a bit of power, not a big man, hit for average, 331, consistent, played two positions. He was the first Hall of Fame player to play two positions more than 1,000 games, first base and left field. He was a great player. But in St. Louis,
a lifetime batting average of 331?
331, right.
That means one out of every three times he came up at bat, he got a hit.
Right. In a sport of failure, he succeeded one out of three times, which is a huge difference from players who hit 280 or 290.
And over 22 seasons. Usually players will have pretty gaudy statistics when they're younger, but when they get older, they lose some of that, and it brings down the average.
Right. Yeah, Mantle would be a perfect example of that. But Musial did fade in, you know, his last 5, 6, 7 years. He was obviously not the player he had been, but since he lasted to 42, he had a couple of great seasons. As he hit 40, he could still hit the ball. You alluded to the being neglected and how they feel about him in St. Louis. There is kind of a flyover feeling in St. Louis. I mean, once it was a top 10 city, back in the turn of the century, and it has since been taken over by the flow of America, south and west. So they do feel that because they've diminished in size and importance, that also their great player has been diminished.
What does this mean for TV ratings for the World Series? Because both of the teams come from smaller markets.
Right. It's a good point. There's always this cliche whenever you get into the NBA or the Major League Baseball, if it's not a New York or a Los Angeles Lakers or Celtics or, you know, whatever those hot teams are, that the fans in the middle of the country or other parts of the country will not care. Or the theory is that people in New York won't care about these two teams. As a real baseball buff, and of course that's still probably the minority, I say that it's so much fun to see other teams. Now, some team is going to win it. The Cardinals have won it fairly recently. The Texas has never won anything until the last 2 years. So I say it's fun just to see new players, just to see Albert Pujols and Cruz and Josh Hamilton get into the World Series and add their names to the great players that we've known over the decades.
Well, this book is about Stan Musial, but it's also about the way baseball used to be played. Do you think that the game has lost something in recent years?
Well, I think there's no doubt that football has taken over in the imagination, just in the kind of spectacle that it is on television. I'm not a big football guy. I much prefer the real football, that is to say what we call soccer. But I'm the first to admit that the Super Bowl and the Sunday afternoons and the Monday nights are a huge spectacle and that people care about it. And baseball, by definition, has been. It's a big country. There's lots of television. I'm the first to say, yes, of course it has. But I also maintain that baseball is a national sport in ways that are hard to measure, that people care in ways like they always know how their hometown team or the team that, people say, well, the team that my father rooted for. I haven't watched baseball since they went on strike, or those guys make too much. But they always know how the team of their youth is going, what that translates into buying tickets. I mean, baseball is selling a lot of tickets. So do I think baseball is still extremely popular and rooted in the cities and the region? Football takes place in a stadium, out by some interstate. It's not really, it doesn't connect it to the day-by-day life of a city, but baseball is.
But baseball did go through those steroid scandals and led to a lot of asterisks in people's minds. Stan Musial predates steroid. Albert Pujols has been called the greatest post-steroid player.
There was an interesting overtone in Tyler Kepner's terrific piece in the New York Times today about Pujols, in which Octavio Dotel, who's a player, pitches for them, is talking
about... Used to pitch for the Mets.
Right, exactly. He's talking about Pujols, and while steroids are not mentioned in that context, Dotel is talking about what a terrific guy Pujols is and saying, I don't care about the other guys, and you know who I mean. This is a man who... and he lists about eight things that Pujols doesn't do, and, run around, drink, blah, blah, blah. And... He said, Albert is different from the rest of those guys. I mean, Pujols, by the way, going into the season, was hitting exactly .331, the same as Musial, which is why they're both on the cover of the Cardinals media guide.
And Stan Musial didn't run around either, at least as far as we can tell.
Well, as far as I can tell, an intrepid reporter that I am, I've got no proof to anything like that or evidence. No, he's been married to the same lady for now 70 years, and ongoing marriage, good family, and really one of the clean living and kind of post-war American Eisenhower years. Guiding lights of sport in a time when those things were probably more important.
Now, Stan Musial came from Donora, Pennsylvania, and Ken Griffey Jr. also comes from that town. They both share a birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that astrologers or people who check out the water should be interested in?
Well, the interesting thing is that Ken Griffey's father, of course, and his grandfather, Buddy Griffey, were all from Donora. Buddy Griffey was Stan Musial's high school teammate. They played on the same basketball team. And in fact, when they went to a championship in Pittsburgh, a basketball championship in Pittsburgh, they were being treated rather badly by a restaurant owner who didn't like seeing a couple of black guys on a basketball team of 8 or 10 white guys. And they all marched out en masse. And so when Musial was playing in 1947 and Jackie Robinson came around, his answer was, and you can't find this quote anywhere in the newspapers of the time because he was not a crusader, but his answer was why he was comfortable with Jackie Robinson playing. I played with those guys, no problem.
But he also was playing in St. Louis, which is a team that had a certain Southern sensibility.
Oh, absolutely.
And a couple of his teammates were open racists.
Yeah, I mean, however one defines it, there certainly was a lot of smoke about some of the Cardinals, and it was a very Southern team, not only in its position in the United States. I mean, it was the team of the South and the West. KMOX reached down to, deep South. But also, most of those players, Branch Rickey was looking for hungry players, and Matt Ayed, he was looking for hungry white players back in the 30s. And so who did he sign? He signed guys from Mississippi and North Carolina and South Carolina. So you had the Eno Slaughters of the world, and they were not happy with Jackie Robinson, and there was certainly a lot of activity to keep Robinson out. Musial did not care, didn't go on a soapbox, didn't do things. It bothers me to some degree to see the new generation, the new breed, judge Musial by the standards, by our yuppified standards of today. There was one review that said, well, he's no hero because he didn't go right to the commissioner and say, see here, this is what you ought to do, as if Musial was, a freedom rider. He wasn't. He was a baseball player who said, I got no problem with these guys. And in 1947, that was a big deal, which young people ought to understand.
Ironically, Branch Rickey is the guy who brings Jackie Robinson to the Dodgers. But Musial didn't have much respect for Jackie as a player when he first saw him.
Respect in the sense of his professional judgment was that the man had a choppy swing. He was muscle-bound. He was essentially a football player and a basketball player, and baseball was his maybe fourth sport, and he felt that Musial just didn't have the swing or the throw. He was muscle-bound and didn't throw well by Musial's eye. Bob Feller felt the same thing, and they barnstormed with him. To Feller's credit, he had a black team, Satchel Paige All-Star team, barnstorming with him, which is how he got to see and how Musial got to see Jackie Robinson. As soon as Musial saw him, as well as Eddie Dyer, the manager of the Cardinals in 1947, they took a look at Jackie Robinson for a month or so, and Musial went around saying to his confidants, we're not going to win, because you could see that Don Ukholm and Roy Campanella, they were on the way within a year, and he knew that they weren't going to win anything until they changed their policies.
My guest is George Vesey. His latest book is called Stan Musial, An American Life. It's published by ESPN Books, which is an imprint of Ballantyne. Well, Stan Musial had this incredible swing, and people would ask him about it. How did he develop it?
He developed it naturally. I mean, he was a great athlete as a child. He had gone to gymnastics group in Donora, a Polish-American group called the Sokol, which is the old ways of the old world, and particularly gymnastics, where people learned, young children learned body balance and some of the things you do in gymnastics. So he was already a developed athlete at 8, 10, 12 years old. He went into this thing, into this stance, where he turned his right hip to the pitcher, he took his bat way behind, he wiggled his rear end, he kind of moved around. And it looked like how in the world would any normal person get out of all that activity and turning around and looking over his right shoulder at the pitcher? How would he get out of that? But as I got Ralph Kiner and Don Newcomb to say for my book, and these great old, and Robin Roberts, these great old guys who would talk to me, it was all a joke, because Musial was such a good athlete that by the time the pitcher was delivering the ball, he knew exactly where the ball was going, and he could unload. He could unlock his hips. He was ready to hit, and Newcomb said, don't be fooled by that. The man could hit anything I threw him.
Well, he had a level swing as well. Right. But he also said that he could spot where the pitch was going, and that's because he had really good eyesight, that he could see the spin on the ball?
Well, I mean, the great ones do. Obviously, Williams did. Musial could claim that he could see, the top third, the middle third, and the bottom third of the ball, and he would say, well, try and hit it in the middle if you're trying to hit it, hit it for rather for power. He also knew there were only 70 opposing pitchers in the National League in those days. So he also, because you played those teams 22 times a year, he knew most of those players, given the give and take of players coming up and down. He knew those players fairly well. So if he would see a pitcher, it wasn't a matter of who is this guy. He had seen the guy 2 weeks earlier in the other town, and he understood that these pitchers, even the lefties, he knew where the ball went and so on. So he had those 70 pitchers scouted out.
Well, he was 170 pounds, which is rather light. Mm-hmm. In fact, today's scouts probably wouldn't even look twice at him.
He'd be a utility infielder by our standards.
And he had very small hands.
Right. I was surprised. I shook his hand, happened to see him in a restaurant in St. Louis, and Bob Gibson was right. Gibson wrote that in a book that he had done about baseball, that Musial had the smallest hands of any superstar he had. But on the other hand, the hands could hold the bat, and they could. He had great hand-to-eye coordination, and well, that's really what counted.
He used to sand down the handle of the bat so he could hold it better.
Exactly.
It's amazing he didn't break it more often.
Exactly. Well, he had taken – the only subject apparently he did well at Donora High School was carpentry.
My guest is George Vesey, sports columnist for The New York Times. He's written about, as he mentioned, soccer. He's written about the World Cup, among other things. And then he's written other kinds of books. He's written about Loretta Lynn, coal miner's daughter. Now we're talking about somebody else from a coal mining town, Stan Musial, An American Life, which is published by ESPN Books, an imprint of Ballantyne. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with George Vesey, who is a sports columnist for the New York Times and has written about a wide range of things, not just sports, but you keep on coming back to sports.
It's my roots. I was in it since I was a little kid, but I was lucky enough to be a news reporter for about 10 years and just get all kinds of contacts when I was living in Kentucky and other places.
Now, sports reporters loved Stan Musial.
Oh, sure. He was such a friendly guy. And in St. Louis, I don't think, and they loved him in St. Louis, I don't think they realized what a prince of this city he was. He came into New York, and as I said, four times a year, but both for the Giants and Dodgers. So he played like 22 games a year in this city. And he knew the restaurants, and he and Red Chandians would go out to the finest places. They loved their steak and their lobster, and they would go play. Ralph Kiner would run into them in a place down the village that they all knew. And so they would, and they'd go to shows on Saturday night, you know, before day baseball took over, before night baseball took over. They were princes. People loved them. They knew where to get deals on things and all of that. And Musial was so comfortable with the New York personality, with the writers, that he could schmooze with them, and he had no fear. He would talk to all of them. I don't think that he ever had a feud or a problem with anybody in New York.
How much money was he making in his heyday?
$100,000 was the highest he made, and then he willingly took a 25% or 20% cut. At one point, he had a bad year, and he knew it, and they knew it, and they didn't have a lot of money. This was before there was really a lot of money in sport, in that sport, and he willingly took a cut back.
Was a superstar. Don Zimmer told me that he never made more than $25,000. The most money he ever made was when he was in Japan.
Right, exactly. I mean, people had normal, very much normal lives. Stan Musial lived in a nice neighborhood subdivision near downtown, South St. Louis, I think it's called, and he had a nice house, but there were no fences, there were no gates, there were no sentries out in front. His daughter, Jerry, who helped me with the books, that she and her older brother, Dick, knew the neighbors out the backyard. They would have communal barbecues out the backyard. Stan would be putting up his Christmas tree lights, and everybody would say, "There's Stan Musial up on the roof."
Now, you say Stan. He didn't call himself Stan. He called himself Stanley.
He called himself Stan. I use the Stanley in the book from an anecdote that Jim Fry told me about Musial referring to himself as Stanley as his sort of nom de bat, that when he was talking about himself as a performer, he would say, "Hey, little guy," he called Fry was a minor leaguer. He said, "Little guy, they all come to see Stanley." And he was just kidding around in spring training. But that was his sort of stage name, if you will. But no, he was known as Stan, and he also liked Stosh,
which is his Polish nickname. Right. Did he like Stan the Man?
Oh, he must have loved it, because somewhere out there in Webland, there's a website called Stan the Man Inc., which will sell you many things Musial, including he is still signing photographs.
So how did we talked earlier about him being considered small, he was a pitcher, wasn't he? How did he come to be signed by the Cardinals?
He started, Branch Rickey had a dragnet out all over poor America, and I guess you alluded before to my having done a book on Loretta Lynn. I have an affinity for that part of the country, which, Appalachia. Now, people in Pittsburgh don't think they come from hardcore Appalachia, or south of Pittsburgh. They think they come from the Pittsburgh area. But the reality is it's the same area. And
it's produced a lot of athletes, football players and baseball players.
That area did. But in baseball particularly, Branch Rickey was going around to the poor parts of the country for boys who would sign for nothing or almost nothing, and he'd just round them up and send them off. He sometimes bought entire teams or entire leagues that he could control on the theory that if you have a 1,000 baseball players, you're going to produce somebody. Ultimately, Stan Musial was the product of Branch Rickey's fevered mind that if you keep, you know, the infinite number of apes typing, sooner or later somebody will type Hamlet. In this case, you sign enough guys, one of them will come from Denora, Pennsylvania and hit 331. Even though they only overlapped for one full year that Musial was with the Cardinals. He came up at the end of 41. Rickey was still there in 42, and then Rickey went over to Brooklyn. So they only worked together. And, of course, in years later, Rickey would always talk because he was this great American character and blowhard, and he would say, I had my eye on the lad. I was keeping track. But somebody later confided that Branch Rickey had been willing to sell him when he was in double-A ball for some money.
Well, he was a pitcher.
He
had an injury that forced him to go into the outfield?
Right. He had played a little bit of the outfield. He was obviously a pretty good hitter for a pitcher in the first 2 years in West Virginia. He was a wild pitcher. He wasn't even that good a pitcher. I mean, by the standards of today where they're more selective, I mean, with drafting and computerized draft and all that, he wasn't that good, but because everybody could, you'd sign a lot of players, that he was worth a chance, so they sent him off. He said he never understood why he was signed as a pitcher because clearly he could hit. He got to Williamson, West Virginia. He hit a little bit. I think he had one home run each of those years or something. And then in his third year, he was pitching in Denora, in Daytona Beach, Florida, and he was playing the outfield in his spare time. His manager...
How good a fielder was he in the outfield?
Apparently pretty good. I mean, when he had an arm, he was playing center field the day he got hurt. And he dove for a ball, landed on his left shoulder, blew it out. And in those days, there was just not the kind of surgery. And you didn't take a kid in D-ball and send him up to St. Louis to have surgery. But he got hurt. His manager was Dickie Kerr, the honest pitcher in the 1919 World Series, and a wonderful man. Dickie Kerr and his wife took in Stan and his wife and their little child and treated them like parents would. And Kerr cared about him and said, you know, son, you're going to have to play the outfield more. So by the end of the season, Musial was a full-time outfielder because he couldn't throw much. And the next year, he was almost ready to be released, but he got another chance to play the outfield and impressed everybody.
And then he was brought up to the majors in September 1941,
right,
when St. Louis was in a tight pennant race with the Dodgers. He said he just wanted to make contact with the ball to be able to stay, and he averaged 426 for the rest of the season. That couldn't have been that many at-bats.
No, I think it was 10 or 12 games. But in those pre-internet, pre-information glut days, the Cardinals and the fans of St. Louis didn't know who he was. I mean, he'd come from nowhere. He started off the spring in March, almost released, and a couple of people saw him. Bert Schotten, who later managed the Dodgers, was a Cardinal scout or manager and saw him hit a ball 450 feet in practice, called Rickey over and said, Mr. Rickey, do you look where this boy hit it? So Rickey did know his name at least. But Musial worked his way up from a rag-armed pitcher who actually pitched against the Cardinal varsity in a spring training game and gave up a couple of long home runs. They pressed him into duty. He wasn't supposed to pitch, but he pitched. Fast forward through a wonderful season in Springfield, Missouri, a couple of months, a wonderful month in Rochester, which was the Cardinals' double-A, second highest farm team. Now the Cardinals call him up. He shows up in St. Louis. The fans don't know who he is. The Cardinals don't know who he is, but he's making these great plays. He's running the bases. He's hitting. He's fielding in left field or right field. And one day on a train, Captain Terry Moore, one of the great old baseball captains, sat on the train as they went to, I don't know, somewhere, and said, who are you, in effect? And he said, well, don't you remember, Mr. Moore? I'm the guy that pitched against you guys in spring training. And Moore started to call over Johnny Mize and Walker Cooper, all these, hard old ballplayers, and say, this is the kid that we racked up in spring training. And Musial said, yeah, that's me, but I had a good year. And they couldn't believe, because nobody knew. They weren't the blogs and the Twitters and the stories coming through. Nobody did a story when he arrived. Even after a few days, I went through, of course, as you can imagine, I went through all the papers out in this wonderful library, the Mercantile Library in St. Louis, and nobody sat down and said, now this kid's been up for 5 games. Who is this kid? Nowadays, somebody would be all over that.
He then obviously stayed with the team. Did he establish himself almost immediately the next season?
Oddly enough, he did not hit well in spring training of 1942. And one of the reasons was we had a roommate who was named in there, Ray Sanders, who apparently smoked cigars in the room and, you know, came in late and other things that ballplayers tend to do. So Musial, you know, this clean living homebody, is in a room with somebody who's disturbing. And also, Musial had never played, had never gone to spring training in South Florida. He had been in Georgia. He'd been, you know, in other places, but he'd never been where there were palm trees and light and water. So to go and bat in a spring training game and try to pick up the ball, I mean, it was a trick that players had to learn to do, that when you played at Al Lang Field and in St. Petersburg or other places, that you had to get used to the conditions of South Florida. So he was not doing well, and I guess he thought he was going to get cut. So he was hitting very defensively, just trying to make contact with the ball. And finally, the manager, Billy Southworth, called him in and said, you know, you are my left fielder. And I guess Ricky also came in and said, you know, my boy or my lad, you know, we're bringing you north, and of course you're going to play. You had a good – but Musial was just insecure enough. I mean, he's a humble person from the time he was young to today. I mean, he has an ego, as any great performer or athlete will have. But ultimately, he's someone who still probably is – awed by how much success he has had in life in every sense of the word. A truly humble person, and one of the reasons why I enjoyed writing about him and getting to know more about him, that he was just not quite the same person as Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio.
Well, he wrote with his right hand, but mm-hmm. he batted lefty, which is odd, isn't it?
He wrote with his right hand because he was made to do that. That's the way they used to handle
it. But he was a natural lefty.
He was a natural left-hander. And in grade school, he was told he had to write with his right hand. He also had a bit of a stutter, and I found some great old study of the coincidence of stuttering and being forced to write with your right hand. There was a Danish or Swedish study, and I'm sure there are many more in this country, that they had. So he was forced to do it, and it stayed with him. He still had sort of speech defects that led him to use nonsense words, that he would use the same things over and over again because he knew he could say them. So if people would talk to him around the ballpark, he didn't necessarily engage them in real ways, but he would say, "What do you say? What do you say? What do you say?" Or a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. That was things he would repeat them, and probably that was a trait of somebody that didn't want to get caught out trying to say a couple of complete sentences in public.
He was a lefty, but he hit the ball to center and left field a lot. Did that help make him even more dangerous as a hitter? Because it's usually hard to hit with power to the opposite field.
He was such a great athlete. And first of all, because he didn't see himself as a power hitter, he was comfortable hitting the ball where it was pitched. And if you do that, if you operate on that premise that you're not trying to power the ball over the fence. So when he came up, he was just trying to stick in the major leagues. I talked to George Shuba, who was one of the boys of summer, part-time left fielder for the Dodgers, great guy, still around out in Ohio. And I said, what was it like to play left field against Musial? Could you shade over? Well, first of all, you didn't need to shade over when Edwin Snyder was playing center field. But also, if you gave Musial the left field line and there was a pitch out there, you know, his 3,000th hit in Chicago was a sizzling line drive past Ernie Banks at shortstop. It was hit so well past Banks that it went into the corner in Wrigley Field, and Musial got a double out of it and not a single.
He actually had 3,630 career hits. He hit 725 doubles, 177 triples. That means he had speed.
He had a lot of speed. He was known as the Denora Greyhound because he ran well. He was a great athlete.
And a listener points out, something you point out in your book as well, that although he could hit for power, he walked more than twice as often as he struck out, 1,599 walks to just 696 strikeouts in his entire career. There are some players who strike out that many times, it feels in a season.
Yeah. There's a great statistic in Tyler's story today, I believe, or maybe it was the baseball blog, that the first baseman for the Texas Rangers has struck out three times in a game 36 times in his career, and Musial did it exactly once when he was 42 years old.
Also, half of his hits were on the road. The other half were at home. Most players play better at home or on the road.
Sure. You also get more at-bats on the road because you are always playing in the top of the inning. At home, you don't get the bottom of the ninth. So in a way, it's an interesting statistic, probably not as overwhelming as it seems. He did hit well on the road, but batted more also.
Now, he wrote an autobiography after he retired. How much can we rely on that?
I think you can rely on it for veracity, if not for completeness. It was done with the help of Bob Brague, who was in the old style of sports writers, was very close to Musial and was allowed to do books with him. Nowadays, from 25 years, that has been not allowed at the New York Times and you know other great papers where you can't have a working relationship. But Brague was a good guy who knew Musial very well. He also was a writer and had an eye for the things that Stan didn't want to talk about. For example, when they were working on the book, they went down to DeNoro and Stan's, maybe his mother was still alive, but Brague said, Stan, show me the house you grew up in. It was a little tiny house where seven or eight of these people had lived, packed into a few rooms. And Musial would barely slow down the car as he drove by. And you know that if Stan Musial had gone and knocked on the door, they probably would have recognized him. But more to the point is, if he'd said, my name is Stan Musial, I used to live here, could I show this man the house? You know, I mean, Pee Wee Reese did that in Bay Ridge one time, many years after he'd been a boarder or a roomer in Bay Ridge, and the people were stunned and thrilled to have Pee Wee Reese knock on their door. Musial wouldn't slow down, and Brague later said in an interview, he just didn't want to go there. He just didn't want to talk about his childhood. His father had some issues. They were poor. They were in a hard town. They were among the poorest people in the town.
The Cardinals' biggest rivals were the Brooklyn Dodgers, but Musial was inducted into the Brooklyn Dodger Hall of Fame.
Well, we loved him in Brooklyn. I wish I'd seen him more in Ebbets Field as a Dodger fan from Queens, but they gave him his nickname. You know, somebody saw him. This is right after the war, and here's the guy. He's, you know, gone for 6 for 8 against them in a doubleheader, and people started to say, here comes that man. Here comes the man. And Bob Brague and the traveling secretary debated whether it was the man or that man, and by the time the Cardinals came back from that road trip, Brague had given him the nickname Stan the Man. Now, the Brooklyn fans loved him. They cheered him, even though he used to, and if I may speak in Brooklynese for a minute, even though he used to moiter us.
Mm. Have you always been a fan of Stan Musial's?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can remember him from the 1946 World Series. I was 7 years old that fall, and it was a wonderful. I still feel that was the best World Series of all time, even better than the 69 with the Mets and some of the others. It was just a great World Series because of having the players back and having Williams against Musial. But he was not a... You know, from 46 on, he was not an enemy in those days. They were good days in sports. This was before the dreaded S word had come in between the Yankees and the Red Sox. You know, Yankees S and the, you know, I don't know if we can say this on the air. But
no, we can't.
Yeah, you know, well, there you go. And it's a word I can't stand. But it was a different time. And while people did say bad things from the stands, that Musial was exempt from most of that. I mean, Jerry West was cheered in Madison Square Garden. Bob Cousy was cheered. You know, the great players were cheered. Nowadays, and of course, I do have people to blame for it. I blame Murdoch, I blame Steinbrenner, and I blame Trump. I don't know why, but I do. I think somehow or other that we're all so sour these days that it's easy to pick on opposing players.
Well, he played for the Cardinals for 22 seasons. Now, that was less unusual in those days than today. Ted Williams played for the Red Sox his whole career. The exceptions of great ones maybe were Babe Ruth. Jackie Robinson quit rather than play for the Giants.
Perfectly made sense to me.
But today, it's a rarity. Pujols has played for the Cardinals his whole career, Derek Jeter, Mariano Rivera on the Yankees, but we don't see it all that often.
I think one of the reasons is now that Pujols is in the last year of his contract, and there's a suggestion that they may not be able to hold him next year. If he really wants the money that he says he wants, the Cardinals, who are admittedly a small market team. So it's different now. I mean, players can make money from middle market. They can go away. It's a different time.
Musial was the Cardinals' general manager for the 1967 season. The Cardinals won the World Series, but why didn't he continue?
His partner in the restaurant, Biggie Gargnani, had died that season. And Biggie was the brains of the opera. And I shouldn't say the brains, but he was the dynamic person. He was a restaurant guy, and Musial relied on him. And the man just died suddenly during the middle of the season. So Musial knew. And he was also a stopgap general manager because the man who had built that terrific team in '67, a guy named Bob Housem, had gone over to the Cincinnati Reds. He wasn't a good fit in St. Louis, and the Cardinals needed him, and they said, Stan, could you step in? He was not a very proactive general manager. He made one personnel decision during the entire season.
Now, I know it makes people uncomfortable to make predictions, but what about the series? Do you think that it's going to be a battle of pitching? The Cardinals' bullpen came together during the postseason, but there are concerns that they're relying on their relievers too much.
I think both teams have. We've got a lot of stuff in the New York Times today about that the pitching hasn't been so great. But the reason is that both of these teams have very good hitting. The Cardinals are hot. They had this young player named Freeze who's coming into his own right at a great time for him. So I would say you could have high-scoring games, and yet probably with all that high scoring, by the end of it, you might see some very good relief pitchers coming in and deciding the games.
George Vesey's latest book is Stan Musial, An American Life. It is published by ESPN Books, which is an imprint of Ballantine Books. George, thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure to see you.